I'm driving around town in my big truck with my big old knobby tires. I like to listen to WHFR radio. I like it because it's different. I like its non-commercial block variety format. You see, some days I may wake up and want to put on my cowboy hat. And some days I might wake up and want to put on a tutu. Well, what I'm trying to say is, some days I might feel like a little rockabilly, or maybe a Broadway musical, or maybe just even a good old-fashioned local news show. WHFR, it's got them all. It's got a ton of choices. It's got more faces than a senior class picture. Take it from me, Buck with a Truck. Check out the big old selections you can get with the station making waves on the web at WHFR.FM and on the dial 89.3 FM WHFR Dearborn.
This holiday season, WHFR would like to remind all of our listeners that our online store is ready to serve your gift-giving needs for that loyal listener on your list. Our online store is packed full of WHFR logo items that make great gifts. We have t-shirts, hats, sweatshirts, mugs, and so much more. Best of all, not only will you be showing your support for our station, but a percentage of every sale helps WHFR continue making waves. So log on and check out our online store today at www.whfr.fm and click the link Shop WHFR on the right of the page. Be sure to continue checking out our website and Facebook page for special discounts and holiday shipping times. And from all of us here at WHFR, have a wonderful holiday season.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone, where local investigators as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. I'm David Twitchell, and you are listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.FM is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And today we have two guests in a conference call. They are both return guests with new information. They are two of the most recognizable names within the UFO community. First is Peter Robbins, co-author with Larry Warren of Left at East Gate, a first-hand account of the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, its cover-up and investigation. He's been on the UFO trail for many years. In fact, he was one of those who testified at the first and only, I might add, formal congressional hearing on the subject in 1968. And we have retired Air Force Captain Robert Salas, who was present at the 1967 incursion of a UFO at Malmstrom Air Force Base, which resulted in all of our Minuteman missiles going offline. But the topic today of today's discussion is on Mr. Robbins' new book, Deliberate Deception, a case of disinformation in the UFO research community, which is a critical review of the book Encounter at Rendlesham Forest by Nick Pope with John Burroughs and Jim Peniston. By the way, Mr. Robbins' book is free for the downloading, and we will tell you how to get that later in the show. So first, let's welcome to the show our guest. First, Mr. Peter Robbins. Hello, Peter.
Hi, David. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. And yourself?
I'm well. And may I jump in quickly to make two small corrections? First, the title of the book in question is Encounter in Rendlesham Forest, and I did not testify before Congress in 1987. I think I would have been considered much too young.
67. Oh.
No.
Well, I apologize.
However, both Robert Salas and I did have the privilege of testifying at the citizen hearings on UFO disclosure last May at the National Press Club in Washington.
That's where I'm getting confused, and thank you for that correction. Am I getting you confused with Stanton Friedman?
Yes.
Huh?
And, he, you know, take one look at me and you'll see no beard or eyebrows, and you'll know the difference.
You know, I thought about that. I thought, you know, that guy looks way too young to be, to have been involved in that in 67. But he says he is, you know. He keeps himself well. I don't know.
Very.
Okay, then let me introduce Mr. Robert Salas. Hello, Robert.
Hello, David.
How are you
today? Glad to be with you and Peter.
Yeah.
My honor.
This is the first time we've tried a conference call, and after pushing the wrong buttons a couple of times, I finally got it, and here we are. So, all's well that ends well. So, at any rate, let's start with Peter Robbins. Peter, what prompted you to write the book, Deliberate Deception?
Good question. I guess about a year ago, my colleague in England, Gary Haseltine, who many of your listeners know, is a retired Yorkshire police detective and one of our leading people in the field in terms of analysis of forensic UFO-related evidence, asked me if I would be up for reviewing the then upcoming new book by Pope, Penniston, and Burroughs, given my background on the particular case and the fact that I'm a regular columnist for his magazine, UFO Truth. I agreed to, was looking forward to reading the book. It's one that many of us with a serious interest in the events of December 1980 in England had been looking forward to. And so I set about reading my advanced copy of the book and began to observe fairly early on factual errors, all relating back to information that Larry and I, my co-author Larry Warren and I, published in the original edition of Left at Eastgate, which was published in 1997 and quite a smash bestseller in the UK, very highly regarded, I might add. And I thought at first I must be making an error or misreading things. I had considered Nick a friend as well as a respected colleague. But the more I read in the book, the more of these untruths kept appearing, none of them credited to our book and all of them only available in our book. In each case, David, what was done was an allegation or an observation or evidence was presented, in Encounter in Rendlesham Forest, but without the evidence attached, or in a manner convoluted or worded so as to suggest that my co-author was mistaken or inaccurate. And in fact, each time he was accurate. So I was very disturbed about this. I literally laid them out on a spreadsheet, and what I saw was a book with a deliberate thread of intentional deception that ran straight through it, disregarding facts in evidence for many years. And I felt compelled to respond in the most complete and detailed way that I could. And the only thing that suggested itself was a book about their book, quirky as that might sound.
Yeah. So which parts of Larry Warren's testimony in the original book does Jim Penniston dispute, and why?
Jim Tennyson doesn't dispute it. John Burroughs to any serious degree, although John takes a few shots at Larry. All of the information I'm talking about was written by, and the source is continuously through the book, Nick Pope, who co-wrote the book with them.
Hmm. So which parts, give us a for example.
Sure. There are lots of parts, but an example would be Nick at one point refers to a rumor, and I'll put that in quotes, that there was a suicide of one of the men involved. Asks Jim and John if they had heard about a suicide during the time that they were there. Neither of them had. Says the only source we have for this is a rumor generated by Larry Warren, and being that there's nothing to back it up, therefore we must conclude that it's erroneous. Well, number one, we know that Nick read Left at Eastgate and read it carefully originally. He received a manuscript copy at his request before the book was published, wrote one of the most glowing blurbs for the book, reviewed it very positively for the Ministry of Defense's own in-house publication, and given the number of times he takes information directly out of our book, I am compelled to conclude that he reread it or reread parts of it in the preparation of his own book. What he neglects to note is of the young airman involved was my co-author's roommate, and Larry was one of the first two people to come upon the body, and to put it mildly, that made him into something of an activist on this. More, he was taken very seriously by the former chief of staff of the Ministry of Defense and former admiral of the fleet, and at the time, a member of parliament, Lord Peter Hill Norton, who not only took him seriously, but brought the matter specifically onto the floor of the House of Parliament and asked the question of the then Secretary for Defense, Lord Gilbert, who said that he had no information on it. But this is a fairly good example of presenting the allegation without the information that actually backs it up and confirms it.
Yeah. Well, do you know if Pope investigated this alleged suicide?
That's a good question. Left at Eastgate, as you know, David, is a thoroughly researched book. It took almost a decade to produce, and it has, I think, well in excess of 300 footnoted annotations. We give the more than 100 sources that we drew from in producing our bestseller. Mm. Nick has not a single footnote, not a single annotation. There is no bibliography. There is no reading list. There are some gaping holes in the index, leaving one the table of contents as your best reference tool and an extremely woeful appendix. So one is compelled to take his word throughout as Nick Pope of the Ministry of Defense. And there is no way of knowing whether he researched or not, although I would say that he hadn't, or he would know better.
So originally, Nick Pope endorsed Left at Eastgate. Is he reneging on that endorsement?
Well, one would have to conclude that that is the case. Again, if you read the book, as I hope many of your listeners will, no matter what else you come away with, and there is literally nothing new in the book to speak of, you do have an understanding that there is this other witness named Larry Warren, whose word, testimony, evidence can be ignored because he is untrustworthy or has nothing to back up what he has laid out in our book. And nothing could be further from the truth.
Did Nick or any of them involved in this other book, this latest book, did any of them come to you and say, you know, we don't have anything on this alleged suicide. Do you have any evidence to back this up? Because we want to mention it.
Sure.
Did they say anything to you?
Not once, David. And Nick and I, who had been friends since 1997, I would say through thick and thin, certainly has all of my contact information. And even up until a few weeks before I began to read their book and to my shock, find all of these deceptive data points. We were in correspondence for many years, often with good humor, and inquiring about each other's family and how we were doing. That, needless to say, stopped during the course of my reading the book when I realized he really wasn't my friend.
Mm. Well, I noticed that Larry Warren makes a drawing of what the craft that he saw in Rendlesham Forest land. And so does Jim Peniston. And the two objects do not look the same in my eyes. So which...
Oh, no. I agree with you 100%, David, but we're talking about different objects on different nights.
Right.
John Burroughs and Jim Peniston were involved on the first night and encountered the craft that they did. Larry Warren and the men he was with were involved on the third night, a completely separate event. So it would almost surprise me if the descriptions did match, unless it was the same machine, which nobody has ever alleged.
No, it would seem they're two different objects.
Yes, correct.
So does Peniston say, Warren doesn't know what he's talking about because what I saw was not what, didn't look like what he saw? Or?
Jim has had nothing but contemptuous, kind of passive-aggressive comments to make about Larry for years now, and all without due investigation. In fact, when my publisher, Stephen Mira, of Phenomena Magazine in the UK, emailed Jim the link to the book, as I requested, in advance of it being published and accessible to the public at large, he responded, and I'm paraphrasing here, by saying he had no interest in reading a book on a subject he had already researched on his own. So Jim's mind is right and properly closed, and trying to have a dialogue with him about this specific matter, or indeed about his allegations of time travelers from the future contacting him with a message for humanity, is a moot point. If you disagree with him, he will cease communicating with you. Period.
Well, that's one way to handle it, isn't it?
It is.
Okay, so now we're talking about time travelers. Yeah, he supposedly saw some what looked like hieroglyphics, mm-hmm. but not hieroglyphics, not Egyptian.
Yeah,
symbols,
letter forms, whatever you want to call them.
Right, and he also allegedly touched the craft and was downloaded a encoded message, binary code of ones and zeros. What did that say?
Well, let me take that back a notch first. Jim contends that during the encounter that he and John Burroughs had at the first night, that he walked up to the craft, observed these letter form symbols on them, copied them into his notebook, which I say was a small personal three-ring notebook, not, you know, Air Force issue, and that he alleges that when he touched one of the symbols, he got that close, that this contemporary computer binary code message of quite a few thousand ones and zeros in a specific order downloaded into his head. He also alleges that 24 hours later, in his room, he remembered them all in order and copied them into, I believe, 16 pages of his notebook. The problem arises that, number one, he also alleges that he kept this secret for 30 years. We do know, however, that it wasn't really kept secret. In fact, I include an excerpt from their book where he refers to the binary code in 1994. He also says, partner at the time in this confrontation, John Burroughs, is on record from December of 2010 as saying, and follow this, that the very first time Jim mentioned this binary code to him or even referred to it was in October of 2010, almost 30 years after the fact. Their former deputy base commander, Charles I. Halt, who emerges as a very complex player in this, says flat out. I saw that notebook many times over the years, but I never saw any pages of ones and zeros. And most recently, and this only goes back about two and a half months, John Burroughs has come forward, and I believe with great courage, takes a big guy to do what he did, to say he has no memory whatsoever of Jim going up to the craft, touching the letter form, or of any reference to the so-called binary code. So we have a number of problems here overlapping each other to start with.
So where is Colonel Halt in all this controversy?
Colonel Halt is all over the place, depending on when you audit his comments. He was somebody who, again, was the deputy base commander. And following the events, my co-author, Larry Warren, who had identified himself from the get-go as a whistleblower, who ignored and broke his orders, who took the matter to the public, left the service in May of 81, 6 months after the fact, with an honorable discharge. Jim and John stayed in for close to another 20 years, more or less. Halt, during all this time, was of great influence on their lives and immediately began to drive a wedge, there's no other way to say it, between them and my co-author, guys who should have been like brothers in this. They all, like the other first-hand witnesses, suffered tremendously after the fact with what they were put through. But more recently, Halt has said you can't trust any of them. And yet again, now is back in sort of good stead with Peniston, with Burroughs again coming forward and saying that Charles Halt has misled him for decades and turned on him and has tried to discredit him as well as Larry. You should also be aware that Jim, again, did something I would have never imagined, and I have tremendous admiration for him. He walked away from this little triumvirate that he had been in and established a really meaningful friendship with Larry Warren, and they appeared on the stage of a recent conference in September in England together, unified in their quest for the truth about what happened in these events.
All right.
Excuse me, but I think you meant John Burroughs, don't you, Peter? You said Jim, but I think you meant John Burroughs.
I did mean John. Thank you. Thank you, Bob.
You bet.
It is Bob, isn't it?
I'm the one with the lilting tones, you see. Yeah.
Always.
Listen, I have to take a short break just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves here in at Henry Ford College in Dearborn, Michigan. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with both Peter Robbins and Robert Salas concerning the critical review of the book. Let's see if I can get it right this time. The critical review of Encounter in Rendlesham Forest by Nick Pope. And, of course, Peter's book is Deliberate Deception. And but I want to take a moment here before we get back to our guests, because I spoke with Nick Pope briefly on this show in July of 2011, and he told me that he didn't believe that there are any governmental cover-up in concerning UFOs. So let me play just this 20-second segment of that conversation and judge for yourself here. I appreciate you coming on. Very quickly, though, is the government hiding something? The British government?
No, I've worked on this for the British government. There's no conspiracy, but everyone loves a mystery. On that note, I'm afraid I'm going to have to say goodbye, but it's been great talking to you, David.
Good talking to you, Mr. Pope. Thank you
so much.
You. Bye. Now, there was an article in the Daily Star dated September 23rd, 2014, posted by Alejandro Rojas. The title of it was UK Ministry of Defense to Release More UFO Files Next Year. And it states in part, and I quote here, Of even more concern to UFO researchers is why these files were not included with the UFO files already released. If a simple FOIA request results in the discovery of more UFO files, it begs the question, how many more files does the mod have? Furthermore, this demonstrates that the mod was either mistaken or dishonest when they claimed to have already released all of their UFO files. Nick Pope, former UFO investigator for the mod, told the Daily Star, and I quote, "This is a huge embarrassment for the mod and will for the MOD, I should say, and will have UFO enthusiasts up in arms. When the government said that all its UFO files had been released, conspiracy theorists didn't believe everything had been made public, and it turns out that they were right." So let's turn to Robert Salas right now. Robert, do you feel that Mr. Pope has been less than honest in was less than honest in 2011, or is this new information made him change his tune?
Well, to answer directly, I think yes, Mr. Pope was less than honest. If there was no cover up, then where is the testimony of all the witnesses, all these other witnesses, which there were many, were interrogated, they were debriefed after the events. Why wasn't that published? Why wasn't that information published?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there was something very significant that happened over the 3 days. Multiple witnesses, we even have evidence in the form of, well, Peter could talk to this at length later, I think, but he took soil samples in the landing area and had those analyzed. There was indentations in the ground. There was radioactive detection of radioactivity. So there was physical evidence. There's the tape recording of Colonel Holt as evidence. Why wasn't this all documented and published by the MOD if there was no cover-up?
Yeah.
So obviously there was a cover-up.
So now, according to Larry Warren and other witnesses, let's stay with Robert here. According to Larry Warren, there were nuclear weapons stored at Woodbridge at the time in violation of a treaty. What does Peniston say about that?
I have no idea what Peniston says about it, but actually, what's interesting to me is there was a recent TV program, Unexplained Files, on the Science Channel.
Mm-hmm.
And in that program, Nick Pope actually interviewed one of the Rendlesham witnesses who testified to the fact that, yes, indeed, there were nuclear weapons stored there, and that one of the objects did come over and shine a beam of light in the weapon storage area. In fact, it penetrated the actual building. I think it was one of these metal buildings, but this beam penetrated that building and impacted the nuclear weapons in that facility.
How did it impact them?
I don't have those details, but the indication is that this beam of light actually went through the building.
Yeah.
I'd have to go back and review that, but actually this program is being shown on a regular basis on the Sci-Fi Channel.
Okay.
Yes, it was confirmed that nuclear weapons were there, and this was in violation of a treaty that the UK had signed, not to have, or maybe it was a law, I'm not sure, but they were not supposed to have nuclear weapons on their soil, at least not from U.S., on a U.S. base.
Were there any repercussions due to this fact?
Well, I think Peter mentioned that Lord Hill Norton brought this up before the Parliament and asked that question. You know, shouldn't there be an investigation? And I think it fell on deaf ears. But
we broke the law. Oh well, let's move on, right?
David, if I might jump in for a moment. First, the weapons storage area in question was the one at RAF Bentwaters, not at sister base 5 or 6 miles away, RAF Woodbridge.
Okay.
Both Penniston and Burroughs, along with Pope, have made it clear that their national security oaths preclude their confirming or denying the presence of nuclear weapons. It should be noted that one of Larry Warren's special areas in basic training was working around nuclear weapons, which would suggest that he be deployed to a base with them. I can also put you in contact with a very distinguished personage now working for the Department of Homeland Security, who was stationed on the base at that time as a nuclear weapons specialist and can testify to their presence there.
So why would there be a nuclear weapons specialist at a base where there are no nuclear weapons?
Indeed.
Okay, that's a, you know, it's a it's a question that doesn't...
Let me even take it a step further and tell you that when Larry Warren and I met in person with Charles Halt, as well as a colleague of ours, Bob Exler, who was a UFO researcher at the time, Halt told us to our faces in person that somehow, he couldn't explain the science behind it, I don't know anybody who can, somehow the beams of light referred to penetrated the hardened bunkers and, in Charles Halt's very descriptive term, quote-unquote, adversely affected the ordnance. Now, Mr. Halt has, I won't say he's called me a liar, but that's exactly what he's done. He said that he never made that statement. I have invited him to participate with me in any kind of polygraph or voice stress analysis or other non-chemical truth-related manner of ascertaining the truth and see which one of us comes up as being the one who is.
Okay, that would be interesting. Let us know if that ever goes down.
Mm-hmm.
And let's go back to Robert. Now, thank you for interjecting that, though, Peter. But, Robert, I guess you would know more, given you were on a base with nuclear weapons. You told me that Colonel Halt, and it was just reiterated by Peter, that the light beams had adversely affected the ordnance. What does that mean? What does it mean, affected the ordnance?
Well, you know, I can't speak to this specific case. In my incident, our ordnance was not affected. It was the guidance system of the missile that was affected that caused the missiles to shut down.
Well, if it did indeed affect the ordnance, what tell our listeners what that means to affect the ordnance?
Well, it would mean that the weapon, the nuclear weapon, was put unusable. In other words, it couldn't be relied upon if needed. So that would make it possibly very dangerous indeed, and possibly affected some of the triggering mechanisms, what have you. Again, I can't speak to it specifically because I don't have those details.
Yeah. And now let's go back to this these ones and zeros here. Penniston insists they're time travelers. What kind of evidence is there that these beings are time travelers or ourselves from the future?
That's what we were both hoping, Peter and I, that this evidence would be revealed in the book that he wrote with Dick Pope. But my understanding, Peter, maybe you can interject here, was that the question of how Penniston came to the conclusion that these were time travelers
was never really
discussed in this book.
Yeah. The fact is that there is no evidence and no proof that Jim Peniston's allegation is accurate. What we have was an implicit promise going back to 2010 that when they did make their presentation here in book form, that they would prove, indeed, that that was the case. All we have is Jim Peniston's word or belief or conviction that it was time travelers from the future. Why does Jim Peniston hold this belief and hold it so sacrosanct? Because, quote-unquote, well, and I can't say that, because they told him. That is why. I contend that there is no time-traveling thesis here at all. Instead, that Jim Peniston was the victim of a highly sophisticated disinformation program, probably one of many that sit in abeyance waiting for certain scenarios where they might be applied to discredit a true UFO event, and in this case, a very significant close encounter of the fourth kind involving American military personnel on a highly secured NATO base at a very critical point in the Cold War. I think I do make a case for that in deliberate deception, but thus far, Peniston and Pope, the best they can do is simply say, this is what Jim believes, so we should take it seriously.
Nick Pope is saying this is what he believes, so we should take it seriously.
Well, Nick is very, he's very respectful of the time travel thesis and writes about it with, I would say, quite a furrowed brow in the appropriate chapter in the book, looking at it from all possible angles, except the possible angle that it isn't what it appears to be. And for someone with Nick's Pope's distinguished background in military intelligence to have neglected to mention that it's just possible that this might be inaccurate or a disinformation program, I cannot accept that that was accidental and he forgot to put it in their book. Again, a book that had been touted as going to be the definitive book on the subject, which it is anything but.
All right, so now going back to Robert now, the book states, Nick Pope's book states that this book has been vetted by both U.S. and U.K. governments, and am I correct in saying this?
That's correct.
Okay, so you know when you think of the book, what is it? No Easy Day, where the you know finding Bin Laden and killing Bin Laden and everything, this big hoop-de-doo uproar about should he have spoken about it, should he not have spoken about it? You know, he did not have it vetted by. He did not have his manuscript vetted by the by the government. Now, had he, obviously, the government feels that in No Easy Day case, he's said things that he shouldn't have, and they would have redacted a lot of his material had they seen the manuscript before it was published. Do you feel that that is the case in Nick Pope's?
No, the difference is that in No Easy Day, I believe the man in question who was part of the SEAL team was under classified restrictions about what he should reveal about their operations,
right?
Which is understandable, and that's why he should have had his vetted by DOD.
Okay.
In this case, however, Nick Pope took it upon himself to ask the MOD to vet the manuscript. And I think it's mainly because Nick Pope draws a pension from the MOD.
Right.
And Bush does not want to lose his pension by speaking out of school.
So
I don't think there's any classified information
Right. Well, this is
if there were this would have been a highly classified incident, which I don't think it is.
So this is my point. This is my point. If Pennison and Pope are saying this is the definitive book on the Rendlesham Forest case, and it was vetted by the MOD, then isn't it highly possible that a lot of the information that would have made it the definitive truth
been redacted? Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
So it's ridiculous to claim that this is definitive because it was vetted by the DOD and the MOD.
Right. But they now, Peter, you did not have your book vetted by anyone, did you?
No. No.
So what came out?
Neither did I.
Good for you.
The fact that Nick actually requested this in itself is kind of surprising. If the MOD had chosen to let him know as a former long-term employee that anything that he writes in book form would need to go through government censors, that is one thing. For him to request a security review is inviting, essentially neutering anything that might have been of value in the book. In fact, at the end of the book, Nick lays out toward the end, these are the things that we have learned from reading Encounter in Rendlesham Forest. I believe it's 14 or 17 points. And with the exception of the obvious fact that the Air Force went out of the UFO investigation business in 1969, that is common knowledge, and that an American officer walked away with a report that he did not have permission to do so, the only new thing we learn is that Jim and John's attorney is going after their records. Absolutely everything else he notes in that list, Larry Warren and I published 17 years ago. Everything.
So he could have put his new information in a pamphlet, eh?
Unfortunately, true. He also robs the two first night witnesses of even telling their own story fully in their chapter on the event, this hugely important event. He writes it for them. Grammatically, it is correct, but it lacks any sense of the immediacy of the moment. He drops in statements of theirs here and there, but it is Nick's book, really, and he dominates it. There's no question.
Yeah. I'm going to have to take another second just to remind our listeners, you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell. We're speaking with authors Peter Robbins and Mr. Robert Salas, who's a retired Air Force captain, and we're talking about Mr. Robert's new book, Deliberate Deception. And now let me play devil's advocate here and just state that, Penniston and Burroughs have the advantage of having been in Woodbridge, Rendlesham Forest, in 1980. Am I right?
Correct.
Yeah. So, but then again, so was Larry Warren.
Correct.
Okay. Well, now that point has been made, we move on. Yes, Dave, is there anything else you'd like to add to that?
Good point, Dave. Thank you.
If I might jump in for a moment, Dave.
Go ahead.
We're discussing the larger issues here. Was there nuclear weapons on the base in full violation of the United States Treaty with Great Britain at the time, the alleged suicide of a young airman? Let's go to some smaller details, because deception is deception. In the book, Pope gives a fairly accurate retelling of my co-author's account right up until he doesn't. He introduces several new, heretofore untold details that have no basis in reality. We were told, he tells us that the beings, the three beings that appeared as part of the event that Larry was involved in, were inside the craft nobody, especially Larry, has ever alleged this or even suggested it, written it, or spoken about it. He says two or three. Now, that may not sound like much of a statement, but when you suggest that an individual cannot tell the difference between two of something or three of something, I think that is profound disservice, and it suggests that their intelligence is, you know, that of an acorn or something. He also states that during the event that Larry was involved in, and I'm saying here flat out, that in the sky above them, there were other beams of light being fired down to the ground. This not only never happened, it has never been alleged, written, suggested, or said by my co-author. Now, I'd like to know where Nick gets these completely untruthful details, because, again, we have no idea of his sources. He is free to write what he wants in this book and not account to anyone. The book is riddled with disinformation and untruths like those examples.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me ask you this. Did anyone ever claim to have any of the principals involved claim to have seen entities?
Yes, Larry Warren.
Larry Warren did. But Peniston just heard, got this message in his mind and saw the, right?
Correct.
And did Larry Warren see these symbols on the side?
Again, we're talking about two different ships on two different nights.
There you are. You're right. You're right. You're right.
But Larry Warren's description of what he did see is very clearly laid out in his description in Left at East Gate and in several drawings that he did after the fact.
All right.
Right. I'd also like to point out that John Burroughs is on record now stating that even though he was with Peniston on the first night, he does not recall seeing a craft.
Yeah.
Or symbols, of course. But I'd just like to point that out.
Yes.
So they have two different memories or recollections.
Indeed.
But again, I think another point I think Peter was trying to make earlier is that these men were messed with in debriefing. Many of these witnesses were drugged, and it's possible with some of these advanced drugs that the intelligence agencies are using that some sort of false memories might have been implanted at the time. So that has to be, I think, taken into account here.
But you just don't know which of the memories are false, eh?
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
To a degree, unless there's physical evidence to back them up. And Jim Peniston, in a very poignant section in Encounter in Rendlesham Forest, and your heart has to go out for the guy, states flat out that he has conscious memories of at least 14 separate interrogations, a number of them involving injections of something, and at least two of those events not involving Air Force personnel, but civilians. I see him very much as a lost soul who is an extraordinary victim here and who genuinely believes the information that has been put into his head about him being the recipient of a message for the future from our time travelers from our future.
Well, there's all different theories as to where these entities come from. Once you get past that barrier of are we alone in the universe / universes, is the UFO phenomenon real? Are there nuts and bolts craft up there? And once you get past that, you know, who are these entities?
Mm-hmm.
Are they from other planets? Are they from other galaxies? Are they from other dimensions? Are they from other times? And you ask this to a thousand people, and you're going to get a chorus of yes, you know, for each and every one of them. So
sure.
you don't know. So that's where the evidence comes in to suggest something, lead us down a certain path. Yes, they are from other planets, or yes, they are from other times.
Yeah.
Where's that evidence?
Well, for the record, they... don't tell the human beings that they interface with where they're from, and when they do, or when they allegedly do, I have my doubts or certainly my concerns about taking any admonitions allegedly from these other intelligences at face value. I will say that 26 years into my involvement in this case, and certainly my co-author, I have never claimed to know what the origin of these intelligences are.
Hmm. Well, there are many cases where abductees will report that their captors will say to them, "What year is this? You know, or what time is this?" And others will claim to be taken from their bedroom, let's say, and when they're returned, it's all forest, maybe even dinosaurs, and then they go back up and they come back down and they're in the right time spot. So if they're able to bend time, if they're able to bend space to get here, they're able to bend time.
Or if I might, being devil's advocate for a moment, mm-hmm. if they're able to present the illusion or give the individual the idea that they have been moved through time or that they're from another time,
mm-hmm.
it may or may not be accurate. Anything can be staged.
That's
and apparently,
true.
And I know this from many years of working as Bud Hopkins' assistant with hundreds of abductee accounts that I was privy to, that they, in quotes, do seem to have the power to put into our heads what they choose to.
This is true. You know, people see huge owls, 6-foot owls. Some
That's
people.
A big owl.
I remember there was one case where this guy says, "You know, it was a 6-foot owl. I wasn't abducted by aliens. I saw a 6-foot owl." Well, you know, okay.
That's got to be an interesting planet.
Yeah, yeah. And other cases where they see deer lined up on the side of the road, just watching their car go by. Not trying to run away from it or anything. several deer lined up. So, yeah, they do implant things in our minds. So maybe we'll never get to the bottom of it.
That's but possible.
For the lack of evidence, I just wonder what convinces Jim Peniston that these are indeed time travelers. Was it the message that he received? What did that message?
Yeah, that's a very good point, and we didn't go into that earlier. The message that he received is most definitely a message. The question is what its source is. The message is very esoteric. It names by longitude and latitude, kind of a potpourri of New Age-related locations from Sedona, Arizona, to a mythical sunken island off the coast of Ireland, and then gives a number of statements which, with respect, I'll characterize as sounding like science fiction. And I think the hope among the believers is that somehow this information, with more science or more knowledge or added information, can then be turned into evidence that Jim's message was from time travelers from our future,
mm-hmm.
but that is yet, if ever, to happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a very ambitious work that you have done in your book. There's more than 400 pages and pictures and data.
Yes.
Deliberate deception, and yet you're giving it away. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, that's a great question, an important one. I hit a point in reading this book that I never imagined I would in my work as an investigative writer, namely that somebody who I had considered a colleague and a friend had put out a book with a conscious thread of deceptive information calculated only to discredit myself and my co-author. And I thought, I could write a conventional book, get it out with any number of publishers and sell it and make money and respond in that manner. I guess I'm a little too much a creature of the 1960s and informed more by idealism than practicality.
Good
but frankly, I didn't want anybody, even for a moment, suggesting that I had responded in the manner that I had out of bitterness or frustration that, gee, I'm being ignored here because there's a new book on a subject I'm associated with, which I think is laughable. And so I simply decided that the almost 700 dedicated hours that I spent researching, developing, fact-checking, and then adding a huge appendices, which includes part of my co-author service record, and as you know, several hundred relevant photographs, that I believe in karma, it'll come back to me somehow, but that this book should be freely available to anyone who wanted to read it and decide for themselves free of trying to figure out some more base motivation on my part. So, yes, any of your listeners and anybody in the world can download this book for free.
What is it, Robert?
Kudos to Peter for doing this.
Yes, yes.
I want to say that Peter has provided a public service. He may have couched it kind of nicely, but I'll state it this way. We do know that there is a concerted disinformation program carried on by what I call the International UFO Cabal to discredit important cases. Make no mistake, Reynolds and Forrest is one of the most important cases because of the length over three nights and the number of witnesses and the evidence, et cetera. And this book written by Pope was effectively a disinformation effort intended to deceive the public and confuse the public about this very important case.
Now, I'd like to appreciate you saying that, but I would like to extend to Nick Pope and Mr. Peniston, Mr. Burroughs, the opportunity to come on the show, and I can afford them equal time. I want to hear their side of it. I mean, it's only right. It's only fair. So, Mr. Pope, Mr. Peniston, if you're listening, please contact me. Email me at dtwitchell. Only one T in Twitchell, T-W-I-C-H-E-L-L, dtwitchell@hotmail.com. Let me know that you're interested in coming on the show and defending your side of it. I mean, I want to hear it.
David, if I might, I not only agree with you on that point, and I know Bob does as well, I would welcome listening to such a show more, as I've done in the past seven or eight shows that have invited me to speak about the book. I have asked, in all cases, the host or the producer to invite Nick Pope to join me so that we might discuss our differences in a reasoned, straightforward way with the host acting as moderator, if Nick would ever agree to it, and I doubt that would be the case, or that he will accept your invitation to come back and refute my claims here. I would welcome the opportunity to be on your show again with Nick and for you to set whatever ground rules and us to proceed in a civilized manner.
It sounds good.
May I add one more possible witness? Why don't you invite Colonel Holt to join you?
Yeah, that's why I asked. Where's Holt in all of this?
Holt is not interested in discussing this with me in any public forum any more than Nick is. I have an entire chapter devoted to him and outlining what I'll call a certain amount of duplicity, including a long, detailed, I think phenomenally interesting email that John Burroughs sent him some years ago asking question after question, to which he responded with one sentence that had nothing to do with the questions asked and has never responded since. Neither of these gentlemen are going to go up against me in any open forum, be it broadcast or at a conference, because I will nail them with their own words.
Peter, we're running out of time. I need you to tell our listeners where they can go to download this free book.
I'm glad to, David. All they need to do is go to the website of the British magazine called Phenomena Magazine, and on their webpage you will see a box that says Special Reports. You click on it, and it takes you to a page with seven books, cyber books, sitting on a shelf. You simply download all seven books in order onto your computer, and that 450-page book is yours. All I ask is that if you read the book and you agree with my conclusions, and I mean agree beyond a reasonable doubt, that you then share it with others.
Very good. Very good. And if you're driving in your car, please go home and listen to the archives. And don't try to jot this down while you're... Okay, do me a favor. Do yourself a favor. And there you go. So, at any rate, Peter Robbins and Robert Salas, thank you so much both for coming on the show today and sharing this with us.
Well, you're welcome, David. And thank you so much for having us on.
Okay, thank you. And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. You click on the talk shows and on the homepage, and then Tuesday Forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, which is ufoimplications.com. So please stay tuned to whfr.fm, the only station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. Now I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. Until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
WHFR, Dearborn.
As typing in WHFR.FM, that's right, WHFR.FM into your web browser, you will be automatically whisked into the magical world of the WHFR website. And what can you find here? Well, schedule of programs, special upcoming events, lists of the last several songs played, as well as archives of our live music shows and our multitude of talk shows. It's very informative and very interactive. You'll also see photo galleries, ways to contact us, and so much more. It's WHFR.FM, our website. Check it out.
Here's a little bit of fiery violin music, courtesy of the Spanish virtuoso and composer Pablo de Sarasate.